it was very hard for me initially to understand that investors or prospective investors didn't want to hear me talk for an hour and have me take them out to some steak dinner, which would be, you know, painful 2 hours. And so what we started doing was asking our investors, hey, what are things that you would need to make a decision here? And what would you want that investment fundraising process to look like?
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in. Hey everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, I'm so excited to announce our guest, Brian C. Adams. Brian, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Awesome. So Brian Adams is the president and founder of Excelsior Capital, where he spearheads the investor relations and capital markets arms of the firm. He has 10 years of experience in real estate private equity and has advanced knowledge and best practices for strategic real estate investing. Prior to forming Excelsior, Brian co-founded Priam Properties, an institutional real estate private equity sponsor, in 2010, and provided leadership and direction for the firm in connection with capital markets, investment management, and investor relations. Awesome. Well, I know you've had a wealth of experience over the last 10 years, Brian. Would you please take us back in time and give us some color as to what you were, you know, what you were doing before real estate and then what drew you into this space?
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to. So I'm from New York originally, met my wife in college in Connecticut. We did the Northeast thing for a little bit. I went to law school in Boston, moved to Nashville 15 years ago now. And my wife's family has a single family office based here in town. And as I was practicing law, I got exposure to the investments the family was making with venture capital groups, with commercial real estate groups. And so I got to interact with sponsors and GPs and other folks in that world and became enamored with the commercial real estate business. I connected with my now business partner, who's a New Yorker as well, who married a Nashville girl. And we started the company 11 years ago. Initially started raising small kind of blind pool commingled funds. Eventually we pivoted towards just purely deal by deal syndication. And today we've got about a $400 million portfolio, which is roughly 2.7 million square feet across 14 different markets, mostly in the Midwest and the Southeast.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for that overview. I'd love to hear, you know, we were talking before the show about what you were doing with Priam and some of the lessons learned. Can you tell us sort of what some of the sort of harder things that you've been through were and how you came, you know, what you learned from them and what you decided to do after?
Sure. You said you want to keep the show to 20 minutes, so I'm going to have to be brief with my commentary, but we could spend a lot of time on this. Like any entrepreneur who's been in the game for more than a decade, I've stepped in a lot of potholes, right? And part of the reason I do these shows and have these conversations is to try to help people not step in those same potholes again. So when I started the company initially, like I said, we were raising small funds, kind of blind pool commingled vehicles. And we started offering up those fund investors direct deal by deal co-investment sidecar type opportunities. And they just loved them, right? So we realized pretty quickly that we were in the wrong business. Once we started seeing the appetite from our investor base on a deal by deal basis. So I think one of the bigger mistakes is not spending enough time actually listening to your logical investor base and your network and your peer group about what they actually want. Early on in my career, I was very ego driven. It was all about how smart I was, the schools I went to, the deals that I was doing. And I would just kind of go to the market and cram those things down my investor base's throats and do more kind of brawn than brain approach to fundraising. And it did work, but it was pretty inefficient. It was fairly painful and ultimately, you know, time consuming. So one of the lessons learned would be, instead of just focusing on yourself and what you think your shiny object is, actually learn what your investor base wants, right? And once you start having an empathetic approach to building your business and bringing a solution set to your prospective investors and understanding their problems and appreciating them, you'll be able to scale your business much more efficiently. Another one that we discussed is, you know, understanding that just because we're in a real estate transactional business and those investments have to make a lot of sense, you can't just be a deal person, right? If you want to actually have a sustainable, scalable business platform in this world, you need to also be a small business owner. And I don't think a lot of operators and sponsors appreciate the fact that they're going to be small business owners, because it's a lot of things that you probably don't really want to deal with: HR, marketing, bookkeeping, accounting, audit, sales, tax. You know, you've got to have an office space yourself. It's a lot of things that don't have to do anything with the transactions themselves, but unless you have that infrastructure built up and you put time and energy and resources into it, it's going to be very hard to be successful long-term. And that was a big mistake, that a big trap that I fell into early in my career as well. And that I see a lot of people doing is, you know, small businesses in America fail, right? I think it's about an 85% failure rate within the first 24 months, I think are the most recent statistics. And so it's hard. So you've got to be able to have the acumen to do the deals, but you also have to have the willpower and the desire to be a small business owner, which not everybody wants to do. So those are the kind of the big two mistakes. We could spend a lot of time on this, but big takeaways, hopefully, for other people.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that's a really helpful overview. And of course, you know, we'll have to have you back in on sometime to go more in depth on some of those aspects. For now, though, would you tell us what it is that you decided you were going to do differently after learning, you know, some of those lessons?
Yeah. So going to my investor base and understanding exactly what my value proposition would be, what my solution set was, and really distilling the product offering that I was bringing to market. So instead of talking about my background and the deals and the investment thesis, anybody in that company can tell you what we do in one sentence. We give people access to direct co-investment opportunities, double-digit cash-on-cash yield annual, tax benefits that come from direct real estate ownership, right? Those are problems that I know my investors, which are high-net-worth individuals and families and wealth management groups that work with those type of clients, all non-institutional but accredited investors, I know those are pain points they have. And I know that my product can solve those pain points. And so with Excelsior, I really wanted to focus on the solution set oriented type marketing and sales process. And it's worked out really well. We have a great group of investors. We've, you know, been able to raise capital in a fairly efficient manner. And it's really helped us distill down what we're doing in terms of the acquisition side as well.
Awesome. So I'm curious, when you mentioned efficiency versus, you know, what you were doing before, which was, you know, required more brawn than brains. So when you're doing it, raising capital efficiently now, what is making it more efficient? And how does that relate to, you know, the lesson that you know, going to being more empathetic?
Yeah, I mean, we're always trying to improve our process, but it was very hard for me initially to understand that investors or prospective investors didn't want to hear me talk for an hour and have me take them out to some steak dinner, which would be, you know, painful 2 hours. And so what we started doing was asking our investors, hey, what are things that you would need to make a decision here? And what would you want that investment fundraising process to look like? What would be the most efficient use of your time? And we took all that feedback. And so now, instead of me, you know, sending a teaser and then asking for a call and then doing lunch or a coffee, blah, 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 people can find me and find out about us anywhere at any time, right? I mean, you can listen to this podcast, you can go on our website, you can listen to my podcast, you can see a webinar, you can read a blog. And I told you what we do, those three things. You can find that out really quickly, 2 a.m. over the North Atlantic on an airplane, you can figure out who I am and what we do. And then if you opt in after that, right, you clearly are interested. You say, okay, I want to see these opportunities. When we send something out, we provide a drone footage with a pitch overlay that's also subtitled in case you're in a place where you can't listen to it. We give you all the diligence files that the lender gets. So complete visibility and into the underwriting and the assumptions and the third party reports, et cetera. We record a pitch where my acquisitions person will present the deal. I will act as a prospective investor. I will ask all the questions that I know my investors are going to have. We'll go through the pitch. We'll go through the deal. We'll do pros, cons. We'll do frequently asked questions. Because after doing this for over 10 years, I know what 99% of the questions are going to be. So we'll provide that video that people can watch themselves. And frankly, you know, people can make their own decisions on probably 10 minutes of their time after seeing all of those things and looking through all the presentation materials, the deck, the one pager, et cetera. And so that's kind of how we operate now. And the feedback's been really positive. And it might hurt my ego a little bit that people don't want to hear me talk for 30, 45 minutes plus, but it's just more convenient for them, more efficient for them.
For sure. That makes a lot of sense. And what would you say about, you know, I know we were talking before the show about now you're doing only single deals rather than funds. Can you speak to why you made that change?
I think a fund vehicle is just a really challenging product type or investment product for individuals and families for real estate purposes. I think for certain asset classes, call it venture capital, private credit, maybe mezz debt or other type of products, it makes a lot of sense to put $100,000 and $250,000, $500,000 into those funds. But for real estate, which most of my investors have experience in, and they have a history of investing into that asset class, they know what they like and what they don't like. And they can pick and choose when the timing and when the risk profile makes sense for them and their family. And they don't necessarily want to just go into a blind pool and, you know, take me for my word that I'm going to do these type of things and get these type of return profiles. It's such a tangible asset that they really like to have a rifle shot approach to investing. And so, you know, that's kind of, I think, the distinction there. And funds are great vehicles for larger groups that want to allocate over, you know, a period of time and a large check and get diverse assets if they have a large minimum that they have to do, like $25 million, $10 million. I think funds make a lot of sense because they, if you're looking to deploy that much capital, you can't underwrite deal by deal. You just don't have the capacity probably. But for real estate, especially because we're doing sub $10 million acquisitions for the most part, they're smaller capital raises. Deal by deal just makes a lot of sense from their standpoint. And I think it's a better product type and investment offering for our logical investor base.
Awesome. And so I'm just wondering, so is it, was it, were the returns like harder to predict when you were doing funds versus like on a deal by deal basis?
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, L-U-X-E-CAP.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
I don't think so, but I think it just was very hard. Half the time we would do the pitch would be spent going over what a capital call is, what a J curve is, how much the, well, how long the deployment window is, how long the harvest period is, the possible extension periods, the how much we were going to raise, how much we were going to deploy, how many deals would it be? And we would always say, well, we think this, but we're going to couch it in these terms because we just don't really know. We have to see when the market comes out. And honestly, after doing this for 10 years, which isn't that long in the investment space, I've already been through two recessions. Things change. And I didn't want to be beholden and pigeonholed into a certain product type a certain geographic area, a certain deal size. I wanted to be nimble and be flexible. And you just can't do that as a fiduciary of a fund. You can't always do that, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's interesting to hear you talk about that because it seems to me, and from my standpoint, that there is currently a trend towards doing more funds. We'll have to see where that goes.
Yeah, I mean, as a fund manager, or as a GP or a sponsor, having discretionary capital is wonderful, right? I mean, it's very efficient. It lets you win deals. It saves you a lot of time when you're making these acquisitions and transactions. But it takes longer to raise, for sure, especially as a early kind of aspiring manager that doesn't have a great track record necessarily. It's just a harder product type. And also, I like having having to prove every deal to my investor base. I like them asking me hard questions. I like them forcing me to sharpen my pencil. Because on the fund side, once they commit, and they're a limited partner in the true sense of the word, their obligation is to fund that capital call. And so I just like this dynamic. I think it works better for us and who we are.
Okay, great. So let's now move to sort of a different area, which is the asset classes that you're focused on. You're focused on office, for example, and why don't you tell us the asset classes that you're focused on? And, you know, some of them are kind of interesting, at least from my viewpoint, given the pandemic, et cetera. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on the asset class you're focused on and where they're headed.
Sure. We own a lot of suburban office. We've been focused mostly, even pre-COVID, on medical office, flex, and some retail as well, a little bit of industrial. But so that's commercial, kind of how we view it. It's a pretty broad tent, and we're opportunistic and have flexibility. We can get into office. You know, I know there's a lot of questions about that, but we kind of touch all those different food groups.
Okay, great. Yeah. I mean, let's just dive into office. So, you know, obviously we had a pandemic, people are working more remote. What do you see about the future of office?
I'm going to give you an answer you're not going to like, which is, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. You know, office is hard product type to prognosticate because these are long leases, right? My weighted average lease term across a million plus square feet of office is probably north of 5 years. So until these leases roll, and there's renewals or backfills of space, it's hard to know what some of these users are going to do. Most people have pressed pause on their leasing and they've done 1 to 2 year extensions, carpet and paint type TILC packages just to kind of wait and see what happens. These are the numbers, right? Pre-COVID, you know, less than 3% of the workforce worked remotely or worked from home. Obviously, you know, post-COVID world, that's going to be a higher number. At the same time, from 2008 up until COVID, there was this massive densification of office where a traditional office layout would be 350 square feet per user, per employee. Some of these WeWork locations or other co-working spots were down to 70, 75 square feet per user. I think we're clearly going to move away from that densification where people are going to want more private offices, places where they can focus, as well as areas that they can be collaborative and creative and have group type settings and meetings. So, you know, I think it'll probably be a wash, frankly, but it will take a few years to shake out. I clearly would be nervous that if I owned a bunch of office buildings in downtown San Francisco, Midtown Manhattan, in the Loop in Chicago. But that's more of a demographic issue than it is, I think, a user office issue. And if you look at the REIT market as a proxy for what Wall Street thinks is going to happen with office, it was down about 40% in the spring of COVID. It's now up 10%. So, you know, I think long-term people think it will come back. I don't think it's going to be a secular decline like some of these big box retail groups. But unfortunately, we just kind of have to wait and see.
And you mentioned urban or high growth or urban areas, office space versus suburban areas. So is there a distinction in your mind between those two office spaces?
100%. Demographics are destiny across commercial real estate, including office. And if you look at the millennial generation, which is roughly 73 million people, the largest generational working cohort in American history, I'm a member barely, but I do qualify. The narrative for a long time was that these people are going to be living in Brooklyn, wearing skinny jeans, eating avocado toast, never having kids or getting married. The reality was because of the Great Recession, that phase got pushed back 3 to 5 years as they got their financial underpinning squared away and their house in order. But this was starting to happen, right? They were getting married, having children. and making decisions about where they want to live, work, and play based on quality of life, cost of living, access to single family homes, which we're seeing play out in a phenomenal manner right now, and access to education for their children. Like most generations before them, we rebelled against the lifestyle that our parents had when we were being raised. And then once we started having families, we wanted the same experience for our own children. And so I think, you know, this demographic shift we've been seeing play out for the millennial generation away from these pricey primary gateway coastal markets, the secondary markets, is really just beginning. And COVID just, like a lot of things, accelerated that trend.
Interesting. So what about flex space and some of your other asset class that you're interested in? I mean, I think the story, yeah, let's talk about flex space next.
Yeah. So for people who aren't familiar, flex is kind of like the mullet of commercial real estate. It's business in the front, right? Office or retail front locations with some kind of distribution, industrial use in the back. And the reason flex is really attractive is it's fairly cost efficient, which means it's cheap. It's typically triple net leases, which means that from an asset management perspective as an owner, I don't have to worry as much about kind of the common area maintenance, taxes, insurance, et cetera. That all goes through to the tenant itself. And with COVID, there really aren't communal areas. So there's not shared bathrooms or typically not shared hallways. It's all kind of single ingress, egress into each specific user bay, which is really nice just from a maintenance standpoint as well as a cost standpoint. And when people are making decisions about where they want to locate their operations, it's pretty cost efficient, right? It makes a lot of sense for a lot of groups. And obviously with what we've seen, the advent with e-commerce, last mile distribution, et cetera, a lot of these groups are looking for some place that they can have office or retail, but then also have distribution. And so that kind of checks a lot of the boxes. It's an asset class that we like a lot. We think it's very resilient, and it's something that we can still, you know, get a decent cap rates in some of these markets.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Definitely an interesting asset class that not as many people are in, at least, you know, in my current circle. And what about retail? You know, retail is also obviously a changing landscape right now with e-commerce, et cetera. What are your thoughts on where that space is headed?
Yeah, I mean, I think experiential retail is still going to be a big part of our lives, right? So you think about bars, restaurants, nail salons, dry cleaners, those type of uses. I don't see them being disintermediated by Amazon, at least not, you know, in the near term. So I think there's still some really good opportunity there. I think grocery anchored strip centers are tough, frankly. I think they're going to continue to be a challenge, but some of these urban infill retail spots, I think it's just been an overreaction by the market. I think you can still find pretty decent opportunity.
For sure. Yeah. I guess it seems like there's so much retail space that is not necessarily service-based. Does that play into your kind of outlook?
In terms of the availability or the vacancy?
Just in terms of like, yeah, what we're going to do with all that, you know, retail space.
Yeah, I mean, you know, real estate people are nothing if not creative and inventive. And if the location's good, right, it's all about those demographics. If average household income is strong, if, you know, passenger vehicle numbers are strong, and if the location is continuing to attract, you know, that type of population demographic that you want to see, people will find a productive use for it.
For sure. Yeah. And I think that's going to be a tremendous opportunity going forward for creatives, real estate folks. Is like, okay, what are we going to do with these spaces if there is extra vacancy? And let's be creative and figure out what will be useful to society. So anyways, thanks so much, Brian, for coming on the show. Will you please take a moment to share with the listeners how they can get in touch with you and anything else you want to share?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I'm very active on LinkedIn. So you look up Brian Adams, Excelsior Capital, shoot me a note, shoot me a message. I'm happy to chat and help any way that I can. If you want to learn more about the existing portfolio or access some of the content or educational pieces that we have, you can go to excelsiorgp.com and there's all kinds of resources there for you to check out.
Awesome. Well, I hope you all go and check out some of Brian's stuff and get in touch with him. Thank you so much, Brian, for coming on. We'll have to have you on again next time to talk more about some of those lessons learned. Thanks.
Some of my mistakes. Yeah. Happy to do it. Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right. See you next time.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.